Well, actually, before I was asked to speak about Habakkuk in our current theme on the minor prophets, I was even had difficulty finding the book, let alone the man. I hardly knew anything about him. So we better start off just to give it some context for who he was and when did he write. And the fact is, there's actually hardly any information about who this man was. He calls himself a prophet, and that could suggest that he was a professional prophet, someone that had graduated from the school of the prophets. But unlike most other prophets, there's actually no information on where he came from, his occupation, his parentage, or his tribe. Now, there's a legend that is found in the apocryphal Bell and Dragon. Does anyone know about that?
Yeah.
Yes. Know about that? It's a sort of an additional writing, and it's put on the end of the book of Daniel. And there's this legend that Habakkuk is mentioned in there as the son of Jeshua of the tribe of Levi. And one day, an angel commanded Habakkuk to take a meal to Daniel, who was in the lion's den for the second time. And he said, no, I'm not going to. So he was picked up by the spirit and plonked in the lion's den beside Daniel. Now, it's quite a fanciful an account, and that's what we think it is. It's fantasy. However, you'll find that written about him quite a bit. Even the meaning of his name is very uncertain. Some scholars tell us that Habakkuk is very much like the Hebrew word habak, from which we get the word embrace, and therefore they claim that Habakkuk means someone who embraces God. There's even a rabbinic legend that says that he was the son of the Shunammite woman, the one who Elisha raised from the dead. But this is based on very thin evidence, and that being that the prophet told the woman she would embrace a son. That's all it's based on. That's a bit thin. But of course, on the other hand, you've got other scholars that tell us that the name is from the word obak, which is the same word without an H, and that means to wrestle, like Jacob wrestled with the angel. And then the proponents of this theory say, well, that means he's a person who wrestled with God. So wrestling and embracing seem to me to be very opposing concepts, and it makes us aware that we can sometimes manipulate ideas on some pretty thin ground. But strangely enough, whether by design or by chance, whether or not his name means embrace or wrestle, both ideas actually succinctly express the conflicting state of mind that Habakkuk reveals as he is challenged by the Lord with some really big questions. So I'm going to suggest that we see the name Habakkuk as describing a man. I've gone the wrong way. How do I get back? Go back one.
Go back on the arrow of the...
Oh, that's it, yeah. Okay. As describing a man who grapples with some very big questions. So it's a grapple is like a wrestle and an embrace, isn't it? With the proviso that might not be the literal meaning, but it certainly is the essence of the prophecy. Now, the one thing we can deduce from the three chapters that bear his name is that he was a lover of poetry, an accomplished musician, and that's prompted some students to say that he was a Levite. Now, out of all the non-information and the misinformation that we have on him, the idea that he was a Levite who served in the temple in the music department is the most plausible. But if we know very little about his character, about his identity, we're richly rewarded by what we can find out about his character. Because Habakkuk, he wears his heart on his sleeve. And in the space of three chapters, we're going to catch a glimpse of this emotional struggle that he goes through as he challenges and God and is confronted with his own cultural bias and his entrenched understanding of God and his people. Okay. So there he is. Now, when was it written? Here again we draw a pretty big blank in terms of an exact date. Thanks, chapter. Thank you. There's no kings that are mentioned that can pinpoint it. There's no events like earthquakes or anything like that that can pinpoint it. And that's, of course, given rise to quite a bit of speculation. But the majority of commentators are unanimous in their thinking that this prophecy was penned somewhere between 607 to 603 BC, and this time frame is based upon the internal evidence in the book itself. So let's have a look what it reveals. This is chapter 1, verse 6. It speaks of the emergence of the Chaldeans, which is the name for the New Babylonians, as a power to be feared. An emphasis is placed on the word, I will raise up. And that indicates that the Babylonians at this point of time were not yet considered to be a major threat. It had not yet reached its full lethal potential. Now, the first Babylonian king was Nebuchadnezzar, and he reigned from 627 to 605. And verse 6 tells us that this emerging Chaldean power would seek to extend its territories. And this is exactly what Nebuchadnezzar did towards the end of his reign. And now when he died, Nebuchadnezzar took over the throne, and he demonstrated his growing military muscle with a decisive victory over the combined armies of Assyria and Egypt, when he plundered the Assyrian capital of Carchemish in about 605 BC, therefore demonstrating that Babylon was becoming a force to be reckoned with in the east, although at this stage it was not a direct threat to Judah, but the old superpowers of Egypt and Assyria from this point started to die. Now thirdly, Kings tells us that good King Josiah, he died in 605 BC, and on the ascension of bad king Jehoiakim, the nation quickly fell into moral decline, and from that it went from bad to worse. And if you want to know what he was like, well, there he is. He murdered the prophets. He was responsible for violence and idolatry. He burdened the people with extreme taxes. And he even took the scroll of God and threw it in the fire, the word of God. Now the rest of his acts in his abominations you can read about in the book of the Kings. Now this gross moral decline of Judah is something that Habakkuk laments and is consistent with what we know about Jehoiakim, and therefore with all this put together the scholars have concluded that Habakkuk was written between 607 and 603 whilst he was living in Judah under the reign of Jehoiakim, and is therefore contemporary with with Jeremiah. Now, if you're not into dates, that's fine. The important thing to remember about this time period is this. There was a savage, rapacious, godless nation emerging from the north, hungry to flex its military muscle and claim more territory, referred to as the Chaldeans. And the inhabitants of Judah, that's God's chosen people, had fallen into a state of utter moral decay. There was violence and murder, gross social injustice and conflict amongst the inhabitants of the people. The problems were internal within the nation. From the king to the priest down, there was destruction and strife. God's law was ignored, irrelevant, powerless, actually burnt. Justice was perverted and never prevailed. The poor, the innocent and the defenceless were the victims to the proud, the guilty and the aggressive. This is the background to Habakkuk's prophecy, the social and political framework of his world, and he was outraged. Now Habakkuk had taken this problem to God on many occasions, but despite his pleas to God to do something about it, God continued to just let it happen. How? How is it that a just God, a righteous God, who hated iniquity, just ignore and disregard all the evil that was going on about him? Why does he just let it happen? Why doesn't he do something about it? This is the first question that Habakkuk had to grapple with. Now this prophecy is unique because unlike other prophets whom God revealed messages to and said, take it to the people and tell them to repent, Habakkuk actually takes his frustrations and his complaints to God. Right. And he cries to God. Actually, the word is better rendered, he shouts at God. How can you, a just and righteous God, ignore all this evil? Why do you allow violence and injustice to continue despite my complaints to you? Why don't you, God, do something about this appalling situation? Now, the amazing thing is this. God was not angry. He was not offended. He wasn't affronted. And I've done this study up close and personal because this book actually admits us into the personal space of Habakkuk and his God. In a sense, we are given permission to listen to the dialogue that takes place between the prophet and the Lord. Now Habakkuk chapters 1 and 2 of this really incredible little book are a transcript of that private conversation of Habakkuk to God and of God's personal response. So there's a Job-like quality to it. Habakkuk is not frightened to question God. And that speaks volumes of his relationship with the Lord and of what God is ready to accommodate. Because he wants dialogue. Friends talk to one another. Friends sometimes vent. He wants us to converse with him. Our relationship with God, though one of reverence and respect, should also be up close and personal. Now, Baxter describes a very simple way to get the overall flow of this little book, and it's just three chapters, and he just says this. Chapter 1 is the burden, chapter 2 is the vision, and chapter 3 is the song. So let's take a little look at chapter 1, in which Habakkuk begins by telling us in verse 1 that what we're going to read about here is burdensome. It's pretty heavy stuff. The contents of this book, they're weighty. And the question is this. Why do you, a righteous God, allow evil to prevail? That's the question. He shouts at him. But before God answers Habakkuk's complaint, he prefaces his reply with a dramatic prologue, almost like the drama this is. God says, look among the nations and behold and wonder marvellously, for I will work a work in your days which you will not believe. Even if I told you. But these words sound familiar to you. The first thing I thought of was 1 Corinthians, where it says, as it is written, eye has not seen nor ear heard. So this expression to my ears conjures up expectations that something really good is going to happen. We often hear them spoken about the unimaginable joys we hope to experience in the kingdom. And that's a lovely thing to contemplate, but that is not what this verse is saying. It's the idiom of the language that can confuse us. For what Paul is referring to in 1 Corinthians is that the suffering that God sometimes allows his servants to endure, that's the incredible word. Like Hezekiah, like his son who was hung on a cross. And in Habakkuk, this marvellous work that God was about to do, well, it's actually not good news. It wasn't marvellous as we understand marvellous. It was a prelude to the suffering of the impending suffering of the nation of Judah. You're right, Habakkuk, says God. I haven't intervened to date, but you won't believe what I'm going to do. I've got plans that you will find hard to understand. Now, what are these plans? Well, we're going to read about them. In verses 6 to 10. I am going to raise up a tyrant, says God, who will lead his terrible army down to your land. He is a proud despot. He will come with weapons of mass destruction, with the most advanced strategies of modern warfare. He is coming, and there's violence in his path. Who he doesn't destroy, he will take captive. Your kings and your military defences will be laughable in the face of this oppressor. And then he will attribute his military victory over my people to his false gods. Cut. To say that Habakkuk was shocked, stunned, is just an understatement, because he actually tells us how he felt. If you look in chapter 3 and verse 16, he says, "When I heard this message, I felt weak from fear, and my lips quivered, my bones seemed to melt, and I stumbled around." And that is actually not a bad description of physical shock. This is not the answer to the problem that Habakkuk wanted. And the thought comes to mind, we should be careful what we ask for. But to his credit, Habakkuk gathers himself together, he composes his thoughts, he braces himself. And he comes back and he replies to God in defence of himself and his people. And firstly, he's utterly offended. You, God, are an everlasting God. Unlike false idols that come and go and change from nation to nation, Habakkuk's God had always been and will always be. So how, God, how can you allow this people to violate your name? How could you remain silent while the heathen nation and their dumb idols take all the credit for your work? And then he uses the term, my God, my Holy One. And there's no doubt that Habakkuk has selected his words carefully. And by using the term, my God, my Holy One, he's appealing to God's special relationship with his people, the Holy One of Israel. Remember, God, you're our God. Babylon has many false gods, but you're the everlasting God. You're our God. We are your chosen people. We aren't going to die. He's incredulous. After all, how can you destroy, you know, us? We're Abraham's children. That would render your promises to him null and void. Habakkuk conceives, well, God may use this nation to chastise us, but he could not possibly annihilate us. Now, having reminded God of his everlasting role as their God, the God of Israel, and the promises to the nation that he can't break, Habakkuk sees another major fault in God's revelation to him, which he's not frightened to voice it. You're of purer eyes than to behold evil. You can't look upon vexation. Why do you look upon those who deal deceitfully? Will you be silent when the wicked swallows up one more righteous than he? So this is the next big question. How can a pure and a just God use an ungodly tyrant, someone who is more violent, more corrupt, more ungodly than Judah, to punish his people? Now look what's happening here. All of a sudden, Judah, who a few verses before was morally bankrupt, to the point Habakkuk shouts at God to do something, all of a sudden, they've become just a little bit more righteous. And you can hear Habakkuk's reasoning. Lord, Lord, I know Judah might not be as good as they should be, after I brought that to your attention, but they are not as bad as them. I mean, look at him, verses 14 to 17. Look at the Chaldeans. Look at Nebuchadnezzar. In the sight of such an oppressor, we are all like the fish of the sea without a leader. You're supposed to be our leader. And you're going to let us be all caught up in this aggressive net? We're not a match against their military might. And so God, by allowing this violent oppressor to go unchecked, you, God, virtually reduce everything to a state of anarchy and allow men to go unpunished for their violence. In other words, one, are you no longer going to lead and defend your chosen people? Are you going to do nothing when all the credit and all the glory is heaped upon your dumb idols? They're dumb idols and not you. Are you going to allow all of this to happen to your chosen people by the hand of a nation more evil than Judah? Are you, God, going to be responsible for violence and anarchy? Now, having got that off his chest, having delivered what he thought was a powerful defence, Habakkuk retreats to his watchtower. His time, God, time to think it over, get back to him with the obvious deficiencies of his plan. What was God going to say about Habakkuk's complaint? So before we go into chapter 2, just let's summarise what we've discussed. In the book of Habakkuk, we're not actually dealing so much with prophecy in the sense of predicting the future. The thrust of Habakkuk's message is a philosophical one. And chapter 1 has highlighted some big questions. Why does God tolerate evil? Well, he's answered that. He doesn't. In his good time, he is going to use the Babylonian nation to punish Judah for her wickedness. But the next big question remains. Well then, why does God punish evil with greater evil? And we'll find the answer to that in chapter 2, which God reveals to Habakkuk in the form of a vision. And once again, there is a grand prologue. They're the two questions. Right. Write this down. Make it plain on the tablets, that he who reads it may read it at a glance. It's very dramatic. I love it. But the vision is still for an appointed time, but it speaks to the end and it does not lie. Though it lingers, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. Now God is saying this. Before I answer you this question, you can commit what I'm about to say to writing. Actually, God is making himself accountable. If we commit something to writing, it becomes legally defensible. So one thing that we can know with certainty is this. Whatever we are going to read about next, it's going to happen. We don't know when, we don't know how, but it will happen. Remember the question that God is addressing? How can a just God use an unjust nation who is more wicked, more violent, more adulterous than the people that were to be punished? And the answer is summarised in Habakkuk 2, verse 4. Behold, the soul of him is lifted up and is not upright, but the just shall live by faith. Now, the answer that God gives to this question contains a text that was pivotal in changing the thinking of millions of people and the course of religious history. There was a poll done some years ago in Australia to determine what was the most well-known verse in the New Testament, regardless of whether you believed it or not. What was the most well-known verse? Does anyone want to guess what it was?
John 3.
That's it, yeah, John 3:16, yeah.
Not Jesus'
word. No. The same poll discovered that the most commonly known text in the Old Testament was the just shall live by faith. Which I thought that was interesting. And although the prophecy of Habakkuk is only three short chapters long, Paul quotes it three times in the New Testament. So I think it's reasonable that we pause and consider exactly what is being said and its relevance to us today. Because if prophecy does not contain a moral message, we might as well study history. Maybe. Might be interesting, but it's just information. So get a grip on what God is saying. I'd just like briefly to consider that 400 years of silence between the Old and the New Testament. Now, silence they may have been in terms of scriptural revelation, but they were very busy years in terms of preparing the way for the Gentiles to accept the gospel, even to overseeing the Hebrew scriptures, which were translated into Greek, known as the Septuagint, and thereby enabling non-Jews access to the Jewish scriptures. That would be a great study, but it's not out today. The crucial factor that I want to make is that the world that we read about in the Old Testament and the world of the New Testament are vastly different. But during that 400 years, the Jewish world of antiquity, as we read about it in the Old Testament, disappeared. The world changed dramatically. And the most relevant factor for us when we consider Old and New Testament is that the thinking process of the people had changed irrevocably. We leave the old world as a struggling nation of Israel, as Israel comes back from the exile, a people who were trying to recreate their pre-exile life. And then we read of the birth of Christ in Matthew, and we are in a different world, a Roman world, a sophisticated world, a powerful world. And Israel, though under the dominion of Rome, had changed. There were Pharisees and Sadducees. Where did they come from? I can't go into it now, I know that. But we can say that the Jews were exposed to the culture and the thinking of the people under whose dominion they found themselves, and little groups, bit by bit, adopted into their belief systems elements of philosophies of the people around about them. And during that 400 years, that silent 400 years, from the brazen belly of Nebuchadnezzar's image, emerged people like Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and they were far from silent. These men emerged and challenged, and they changed the way people thought. The great Greek philosophers and thinkers of antiquity influenced the world and the way people perceive themselves and the world around them, and we are the recipients of that thinking. And Greek philosophy was miles apart from Jewish philosophy. To the Jew, there was a fundamental knowledge that God was, and everything was built upon that undeniable, solid fact. But to the Greek, exposure to multi-god societies and free thinking had broadened the outlook, and the Greek philosopher questioned, who was God? Did a supreme God exist? Was he many? Was he one? Was he none? What was man? What was his purpose? Where did he come from? Where was he going? The Greek posed these questions in beautiful oratory and poetry, but they rarely concluded with an answer. The end result was always a question, a striving for the unknown, for the unattainable. Love that, don't you? Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is not omnipotent. Is he as able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Then whence cometh evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God?
It's so human,
isn't it? Getting back to the crux of the study, the most noticeable difference in Greek and Hebrew thinking was the separation of mind and body. The body and intellect, reason, the Greek, were two separate entities, often conflicting, so that you could think one thing with your intellect, but your actions may not necessarily reflect what you thought. And this type of thinking filtered into the Roman Empire, and a whole language developed to express the concept. Now, with this in mind, I want us to consider the word faith. If you do a search in the Old Testament, in the modern King James Version, you will find the word faith occurs in the Old Testament on one occasion only. That being the one that's before us today. But if you do a search in the Old Testament of the words faithful or faithfulness or faithfully, you'll find it over 100 times. But if you do the word faith in the New Testament, it comes up 227 times. Now, can you see the difference in these two words? Faithfulness in the Hebrew context refers to lifestyle, how a person lives out their life in a state of belief, according to their state of belief. Faithful describes what type of person someone is in relation to their belief. She was a faithful wife, he was a faithful servant. Old faithful is the dog, you know. But when we see faith in the New Testament, we tend to put the emphasis on the mental aspect, and we do this because we've been influenced by Greek thinking. The Greeks separated faithfulness and they called faith the mental component. And this is why Paul and James in the New Testament had to go to great lengths to explain to their readers that Bible faith without works is dead. Faith does things, writes Paul in Hebrews. By faith Abraham did this, by faith Samson did that. And these were concepts which would never ever have to have been laboured over and explained to an ancient Hebrew. And I think the reason Habakkuk 2 verse 4 has been translated as faith instead of faithfulness, as if every occurs in every other instance, is to bring it in line with Paul's expression, who quotes this verse three times in the New Testament using the common vernacular of the word faith, but with the appropriate explanation. Now, with this in mind, let's return to the dilemma Habakkuk's facing. How can a just and just God use this unjust nation, who was more wicked, more violent, more adulterous than the people he was going to punish? Was this fair or was it right? And God's reply to this question is this. There are two types of people in the world. There's the proud. The proud who are self-reliant, self-motivated, self-willed, self-interested, self-absorbed, strong in his own might. These people's souls are not upright. Then there is the just, the man who depends on God to live a faithful life. The idea is not the righteous by faith shall live. It is more correctly translated, the just shall have life because of their faithfulness. Notice God is now breaking it down to the individual. We're no longer talking about nations, we're not talking about Judah and we're talking about Babylon, we're talking about people. It is not a contest between which nation is worse or which sin is worse. The basis of salvation is a life of faithfulness. A proud man depends on himself and lives. He lives an unfaithful life. A just man depends on God and lives a faithful life. Just as an aside, I'm not too long. Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk who went on a pilgrimage to Rome, and in his sightseeing he came across this church which was supposed to have been built over the staircase that led to Pilate's chambers where Christ would have been taken. So the Pope said, look, anybody that climbs these stairs will get an indulgence, but not on your feet, you had to do it on your knees, and as you went up you had to kiss every step, because it was assumed that the blood of Christ would have fallen on the step. Now Luther, who had just got there and who was quite weak because he'd been very sick, started to climb up, and he got halfway up. And he started to think about Habakkuk, and he started to think about this verse, the just shall live by faith. And apparently halfway up, he saw the light. He saw that salvation was not dependent on the achievements of man, in his case, climbing up stairs or paying penances or whipping themselves, all those types of things that they used to do in a monastery life. Salvation was dependent upon relying upon God to live a faithful life. That's why Paul uses this in Romans when he appeals to the competition and the resentment that was building up in the ecclesia between Jews and Gentiles. Salvation is not dependent upon being a Jew or being a Gentile, being under the law or being above the law. Salvation is dependent upon relying on God to live a faithful life. And in Habakkuk, salvation was not dependent upon being one of God's chosen people. It was dependent upon living a faithful life. And yes, pride will be destroyed, however it is manifested, in God's good time. Now, if you want a description of the outworking of pride and its eventual consequences, verses 5 to 19 in chapter 2 gives us a very accurate description of the Babylonian Empire, as we have come to understand it historically, under the command of Nebuchadnezzar, and of their ultimate demise, which came to pass when Cyrus entered the city during their drunken orgy in 539 BC. Now, this vision is described in the form of a poem. There's old Martin Luther. And that's Paul. He uses this expression three times, but it's always a common theme. Salvation is not dependent upon outward things. Now, he does, Habakkuk, or actually it's God in the vision, describes the fate of Babylon in the form of a poem. It's a little chant, really. It's almost like a ditty. And it depicts the consequences of the terrible deeds of the Babylonian and her proud leader, Nebuchadnezzar. This is what God has in store for Babylon. This is the ultimate outcome of that proud nation. And what is the outcome? Well, I'm going to tell you, it's woeful, 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 woeful. It's terrible, 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 terrible. Five times woeful. So in comparison to those who lead faithful lives, that's the just, the proud Babylonian, with all his horrible and rapacious characteristics, may be used by God for a purpose. But woe, how terrible it will be for them when God no longer needs them. For what they have dished out without repentance in the long term, they will receive. Just look at this. You are a proud nation of foolish drunkards. The people you have robbed and violated will rise up and take everything you have. The stones of your great so-called secure city will be looted by your victims, and you will fall and pay for it with your lives. All your efforts to expand your kingdom, which you carried out with bloodshed and crime, will come to nothing. You'll be stripped naked and shamed, like you enjoyed doing to others in your drunken orgies. Your wooden idols, which you worshipped, will be useless. They will not hear your pleas for help. It's not a nice picture, is it? What a horrible, yet a very accurate description of the end of the Babylonian power. And yet, cushioned into this depressing and frightening scene, the faithful are given three lifelines, three pictures of hope amidst despair. Worry. We have a choice in the beginning of the poem. We don't have to be proud. We can be faithful. In the middle of the poem, don't worry. God has a plan. All the earth will be filled with his glory. That's not going to be thwarted by anyone. And at the end of the poem, don't worry. God is in control. Now, don't you think Habakkuk, who's been so vocal, be a little appeased at this revelation, a little happy, a little relieved that it's Israel's enemies were going to get there? Before we answer that question, just let's go back to that slide. I'm going the wrong way. Let's recapitulate Habakkuk's response to God in the beginning. The wicked violate the righteous. What's the difference? Strife and contention, there is no justice. Destruction and violence, bloodshed. Immorality prevails. God's law is ignored. What's the difference between, you know, ignoring God's law or worshipping idols? Actually, at least they worshipped them. These people had the God of Israel and they ignored it. What's the difference between the Babylonians and the children of Judah, comparing them with Habakkuk's own words? Why does the normally forthright Habakkuk remain silent? Habakkuk, who shouted at God to do something about the gross injustice and violence that his people were perpetrating to one another? Well, Habakkuk was forced to see the Babylonian character of his own people and realise that God was just in his judgment upon them both. Judah, God's chosen people, were as steeped in immorality and as accountable for their sins as Babylon. And I think by the end of chapter 2, Habakkuk begins to see the big picture. His bias has been exposed. His defences have been wiped out. And he no longer questions God's judgment. Why does God appear to tolerate evil? Well, he doesn't. It's dealt with in God's good time. Why does God punish evil with bigger evil? Well, the fact is evil. There is no grading of sin. God will eventually remove all evil, whether it's in Babylon or whether it's in Judah or whether it's in Australia or whether it's in Arabia. And what is the basis for salvation? Faithfulness. That Habakkuk understood and accepted this message is reflected in the third chapter. And this is, it's actually a song. It's sung as a song and it's complete with musical interpretations of how it ought to be played and sung. In your own version, you may find this funny word, shigionos. Mm-hmm. And well, that means, it's actually a musical description. It means a song with intense feeling. And sometimes the translators have really gone off the plank, you know, the board here, so they've used this obscure rendering of erring ones. Has anyone got that? Well, it's actually talking about the music. It's describing a rising crescendo followed by a diminuendo. And this expression, you know, it causes rapid change in the song, which to reflect the emotion. As if the music runs away and then you pull it back like an erring one. And of course this adds weight to the idea that Habakkuk was a Levite who worked in the music department. Oh, I didn't know what to call it, but it sounds right. In chapter 3 we see that Habakkuk had processed God's message and was humbled by it. Unpalatable as it may have been, he now understands that God is just. He knows now that God is right in condemning evil, wherever that is. It is the individual who relies on God to live a faithful life who will find salvation. But that doesn't mean that Habakkuk was still not fearful of what was going to happen. Last class, somebody, I think it might have been Rosemary, said she found the concept of, you know, all these invading armies and the fact that it may happen in our times frightening. Well, if that's how you feel, and it certainly is how I feel at times, remember Habakkuk felt the same way. Oh Lord, he said, I heard your report and I was afraid. So he did the only thing possible. He took his fear to God and he pleads for God to be merciful to his people. And he does this in the form of a heartfelt hymn. Habakkuk's saying in chapter, the verse 1 of the chapter 3, in sort of an obscure way, but I think this is what he's actually saying. Do what you've got to do quickly. Get it over with, and then show mercy to your people. He no longer appeals or argues for justice. He did that once, and he wasn't prepared for the answer. He doesn't even ask for forgiveness for his people. But he prays that if it's possible, please cut this time of judgment short. Lord, in your anger, remember you are a merciful God. Please be merciful. Now this song has strong overtones of David's Psalms and also of the Song of Solomon, Moses and Deborah. And you get the impression that Habakkuk flicked through all the temple scrolls, you know, extracting excerpts and ideas that expressed how he felt about the revelation that God had given him. And that's just a few of some of the very apparent extracts that have come through in it. In chapter 3, Habakkuk attempts to stir up God's emotions with music, with beautiful melody and lofty poetic lyrics, targeted to remind God how much he had loved his people in the past and how many times in Israel's history God had interceded and protected them from their enemies and shown them great mercy. And music is such an emotional medium. What person can remain unmoved when serenaded by a lover? And Habakkuk now woos God with memories of the past, how God had brought them out of Egypt, provided deliverers, destroyed their enemies, and just how much he had loved them. Could God, who had shown so much devotion to his people in the past, not be entreated to extend them mercy in the future? Now I've tried to, I've tried to recreate something of the pathos of this appeal that Habakkuk presented to God. And I've taken the complex imagery of the poetic language and tried to put it into the sense that we could quickly understand it, so that we just get an overview. So you need to be able to see the screen. Can everyone see the screen? I was actually going to try and read it in a dramatic voice, but my voice has had it. So you just need to...
No, I can't.
Yeah, anyone? Yeah. Is that better? Is that better?
Oh, yeah.
What about people over here?
Thank you.
matter. She knew the Exodus. Matt said to me, if I ever hear of a country day. And thank you very much to Julie, who Julie and Sam yesterday, because it wouldn't go, and they fixed it. Anyway, I just love... Oh, that's the wrong one. I just love that analogy of the hind.
Yeah,
because, yeah. Oh, they're known for being able to walk along very dangerous, steep and slippery paths, you know. And I think there's no doubt that Habakkuk knew that the road ahead was going to be pretty rocky, but he knew that he could trust in God for his deliverance. You know, these three chapters have revealed so much about this man. We've gone from chapter one, in the beginning, where we hear him angry and indignant, and then the second half of chapter one, we see a confused and frightened man. And by the end of chapter two, we see a humbled and submissive man. And in chapter three, we see this sensitive and passionate and faithful man who will trust in God for whatever the future may hold. From shouting at God to be just, Habakkuk concludes his prophecy by singing to God to be merciful and finding peace in leaving it all with God. Now, in terms of the prophetic forecast, what did Habakkuk tell us about the future? Well, the prophecy against Judah came to pass about 3 to 4 years after we thought this was written about. And then, of course, Babylon fell in 539 BC, just as God said it was. But I think that God has a little surprise waiting for Habakkuk. Although I didn't know, I don't know whether he actually saw it in his time or whether he's going to hear about it in the kingdom. But it certainly took me by surprise. Because the model that God gives Habakkuk, that symbolically, excuse me, epitomises all that is ungodly. I'll start that again. The model that God gives Habakkuk that symbolises everything that is ungodly was the literal nation of Babylon and the proud and fearsome man who headed this terrible regime, Nebuchadnezzar. So does anyone know where the twist is?
Oh, because Nebuchadnezzar.
Well, Daniel 4...
Sorry, Nancy, what was the word? Does anyone know what happened?
The twist. Where's the twist of this? Yes, yes.
Thank you.
Sorry.
All right. No, I read a mighty form.
Well, Daniel chapter 4 verse 37 reveals another song, but this time by a very different composer. This is the song that was written by... right. Going the wrong way. Nebuchadnezzar. I, Nebuchadnezzar, am singing and praising the King of Heaven. Everything he does is right. He knows how to turn a proud person into a humble man or woman. That was amazing.
Amazing. It was a lot to do with singing, though, didn't it?
It did.
Crawling around in the seeding grass.
But this is the man who headed the nation that Habakkuk lamented was more evil than Judah. And he was converted. The man by whose hand God would punish Israel for her gross sins became one of the most dramatic converts in the Bible. And all because a few faithful Jewish men refused to bow down to him. Like Paul says in Romans, for in it is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith. Or if you want to put it in a better way, the faithfulness of a few was effective in converting Nebuchadnezzar from their faithfulness to his faithfulness. And as a result, they'll be given life. Now compare that to the summary of Jehoiakim, the reigning king of Judah, in the time of Habakkuk. You shall not mourn for him, nor lament him. He shall be buried with the burial of an ass, drawn and cast forth beyond the gates of Jerusalem. That's incredible, isn't it? Who was the real king of Babylon? Mm-hmm. You never know. You never know what living a faithful life can do. You never know how much power is in it.
And that's what, like, it is individual.
That's right.
Not nations.
It's not nations, that's right.
It's one man, every individual.
Yes.
And back.
Yes. Now look, the cycle of Judah's destruction and captivity and oppression followed by the ultimate defeat of the enemy, it's not a new revelation. Now Isaiah had foretold it 120 years ago before this, I mean, and Jeremiah dedicated his life to that message. And even earlier in the book of Judges, it's full of the history of defeats by the enemy and after Israel had been oppressed and taken captive and suffered and repented, they are delivered by an appointed leader who soundly conquers the oppressor. That's cycle after cycle in the background. And that cycle has continued through the ages. It was evident in AD 70, even Hitler to some degree. And it might even be happening as we speak, you know. But the main thrust of this book is not about the literality of the prophecy, for example. It's not about who this invader is going to be or when will it happen or how will it happen. It's more about the philosophy of why it happens. And what do faithful people do if you're caught up in it? It happens because of the pride and arrogance of men. And it will continue to happen because ungodly citizens of all nations will not look to God for deliverance. They will not turn away from evil, whether in the East or whether in the West, whether them or whether us. But the Song of Habakkuk, though an appeal to God to remember how he had loved them in the past, it is impregnated with hope for the future. For God will have mercy on his people. He will not forget how he's loved them, and he will provide his anointed Joshua, Jesus, who will lead the assault against the enemy. It is God's appointed son who will subdue the nations, will bring about goodwill and peace on earth. But before redemption, there is often suffering, and there may be tribulation and suffering in the nations before the final outcome. It's a frightening thought, particularly if we're living in those days, or our children. And it is our prayer, it is our really, you know, sincere prayer that God will extend his mercy on his people and on us, his children by adoption. It is our prayer that the time of judgment and tribulation will be cut short. But what do the faithful people do when they find themselves living in these frightening and violent times, and it could very well be ours? Well, because of Habakkuk's message, we can strengthen the armoury of our faith. We can have confidence and rejoice that as surely as God lives, all the earth will be filled with his glory. We can rest in God's strength, knowing that he is in control. But most of all, and you can write this down, you can make it plain so that he who reads it can understand, because what I'm about to say will come to pass, won't linger, wait for it, it will happen. The just shall have life because of their faithfulness.